This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty, filling in today for Craig Cohen. Good morning. Ahead this hour, we discuss the big stories in Houston healthcare in 2023 with Houston Public Media health reporter Sarah Willa Ernst, plus the history of the lie detector test and why it's still being used despite its unreliability. Also this hour, we pay a visit to a student robotics competition. But first, Southwest Airlines is still facing scrutiny after winter storms and technological difficulties caused the airline to cancel or delay thousands of flights last week, leaving hundreds of thousands of holiday travelers stranded. Southwest has since returned to a more regular flight schedule, but the debacle has left many wondering how the disaster happened. Even Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg tweeted on Friday that the U.S. Department of Transportation would be investigating the fiasco. So how exactly did the Southwest Airlines meltdown happen, and how could travelers prepare themselves should something like this ever happen again? To discuss, we welcome Janine Iannarelli. She's the founder and president of Paravion, an international private aircraft broker based in Houston. Good morning, Janine. Welcome to Houston Matters.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to join you.
First, can you just kind of remind us how all of this happened? It just wasn't just bad weather, was it, right?
No. It certainly started as bad weather. All the airlines experienced difficulties in trying to manage flights, move passengers from point to point in the early days leading up to the Christmas holiday and over the Christmas holiday. But it became readily apparent within a few days past the Christmas holiday that Southwest had a unique problem, though it had yet to be defined by, let's say, Tuesday morning.
What was that technological issue that occurred?
Well, you know, we were all scratching our heads in those first few days, you know, and it was clear to me that this is beyond weather related. But what that problem was, well, that was lacking in the messaging initially from Southwest. It has since come to light that it would be what I could only call logistics management. And the logistics management is not just moving passengers, it's moving flight crews as well as airplanes. And then further to that, we learn it was an internal failure with their own optimization system.
So this is a sort of a computer system, outdated computer system for moving and planning all that logistics and organizing all that, right?
That's a very good observation. I mean, it could be a combination of both hardware as well as software. I mean, those are intimate details that are probably only known to the tech people there at Southwest as to what needs to be upgraded. And from what research I've done or reading, I should say that Southwest certainly has a strategy for investment for upgrades. They've made some, and if I may, I'd like to point out, it seems that they've made a fairly significant one in tracking their own maintenance and coordinating it into a single source of information. And for your listeners, what's very important about that is, you know, one, you want to know what's coming due on an airplane and what's just been accomplished. And in a fleet as large as that, that's really hard to track. Yeah, it may sound surprising to you all, but, you know, it's a combination of old school handwritten documenting records and then making them into a digital format where everyone has access to that information. For me, that would be priority number one at any aircraft operation, is to know the status of your aircraft at any point in time.
Was that the reason this all affected Southwest so much more than other airlines, or are there other factors at play?
Well, that's another good point that's being made, that, you know, who knows? Who knows how they allocated their resources? I mean, there clearly is a plan for upgrades. And like any company, you have to take decisions as to where do we make our investment. And some of that is, do we invest in people, which would be hiring crew? You've all heard about shortages for skilled professionals in the aviation industry. Do we invest in airplanes so we can grow the business? Do we acquire gates? Or do we invest in our own infrastructure? And clearly it seems that there's not enough of a balance or allocation of capital and human resources into the infrastructure upgrade, and that contributed to the collapse.
I understand that Southwest flies its routes a little differently than some other airlines. Did that factor in to this too?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, they built their great success on flying what they call point to point, going into cities that are not necessarily well serviced, but not also where they do not have as many airplanes coming and going. So it may be an aircraft that departs for one city, you know, deplanes its passengers, picks up its next group, and flies onward. If there's a breakdown in the system in that point, there's not another airplane to transfer to. They have to bring one in. Or if something happens with a crew member and you're short crew, same problem. Hmm. So what was the key to their great success also was their Achilles heel.
And that's opposed to other airlines who fly the hub and spoke model, which is you fly out of a hub and then back to it before flying to another destination, right?
That's correct.
Okay. You've been following and working in the airline industry for plenty of years now. Can you give me some context just regarding how a situation like this one stacks up? Have you ever seen anything on this scale before?
No. I mean, what can you equate it to? I think it would be the massive shutdown of the airline, the airspace after 9/11, wow, when you grounded everything and then you had to restart it. Every single airline coming and going out of the United States. No, I can't say I haven't. I fly a lot, and I've certainly run into my share of difficulties, and you just sort of roll with it. But something like this, this had to be very upsetting to a lot of people.
And Houston has some busy airports itself. I mean, did this affect our airports and travelers here any differently than other places, or just more of the same thing?
Any airport where Southwest has a major presence felt the same pain. You can only imagine what Hobby was like. I had friends who were trying to depart the day after Christmas and told me that it was just acres and acres of bags and people just not sure what to do next. Mm. It's a complete mess.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, some of that obviously affected some greatly people's holiday travel plans, getting to and from where they were trying to go. I mean, are the effects of this, though, still being felt? Is this being sorted out still, even though we're a few days into the new year?
It seems not. I think that they've cleared the congestion and people are now back to a regular schedule. I mind my own words, I should say, in that I am remote at this point in time and planning to travel back to Houston, but I purposely do not schedule the day of or the day after a holiday because I know it's going to be the busiest time. And today we have a little bit of weather moving across the country, so that's going to add to some delays. But overall, in looking at a flight map, things seem to be rather smooth.
I was going to ask you what travelers can do to prepare themselves for something like this, if anything, because, I mean, some of this is no one could have predicted. But, I mean, yeah, something like you just said, some people are going to bite the bullet and fly the day before or after a holiday just because they have to for whatever reason. But, I mean, you're taking a risk, I guess, when you do that, right?
That's exactly right. Well, I don't think anyone will look at travel quite the same, at least not for the short term. So you have to plan carefully. You can't plan for an event that just occurred. But what you can do if you find yourself in the middle of it is react quickly. Again, I have traveled enough throughout the course of my career to realize some problems are bigger than others and that I ought to be looking for an alternate means of transportation immediately. And sometimes that includes getting a rental car and completing the trip via rental car. Sometimes it means if I'm already at my home base, simply delaying the flight to another day. And other times, because I've been stuck on the road, finding a hotel room rather quickly because I know they're going to disappear.
Yeah. We're going to talk in a moment about the damage this might do to Southwest's reputation among consumers in a moment with a public relations expert. But I wanted to get your take. I mean, the airline has made much ado, about its corporate culture and customer service and different things. But what do you see here? Is this all a sign that it's maybe not so much the case as it used to be, or what signs that things are changing have changed at Southwest?
Well, I think it's definitely different. I mean, I don't think this is Herb's airline, but listen, everybody has to grow, and you grow in different ways. You don't want to move away from your core corporate culture, but you do need to expand and adapt. So I think the biggest mistake that Southwest made in the whole event is to not get the message out there sooner that they're having an issue and that they intend to deal with it. They have since made admissions as to the shortcomings. They're making some compensation allowances to passengers. And I think that the airline is on the right track. I think the CEO has an agenda which includes addressing these problems and making sure that they will never happen again. I mean, overall, Southwest is a great airline to fly. And the pain that people felt, while yes, it still hurts, they'll forget it. I mean, the model of Southwest is such that you can't turn away from this airline. They go to the destinations, particularly if you live in the Southwest, where you want to go, and their price point is very attractive while still delivering great customer service for the most part.
Janine Iannarelli is the founder and president of Paravion. It's an international private aircraft broker based in Houston. Janine, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. And to discuss how these events might affect Southwest Airlines from a public relations standpoint, we welcome Jennifer Vardaman, Associate Professor and Director of the Valenti School of Communication at the University of Houston. She has an extensive background in public relations. Dr. Vardaman, good morning to you.
Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. What was your initial reaction as you saw all this happening in airports around the nation?
Well, it was a little bit of, to be honest, it's a little bit of disappointment and sadness. So as a public relations educator and professional, Southwest has always been kind of a textbook case that we've learned about since, you know, undergrad and all of my times in looking at how a leader can bring forth an organization in by valuing its employees as its most important asset and really bringing forth culture in ways that other giant corporations really haven't. And so from a communication standpoint, Southwest has always kind of been a darling of our world. And so it was sad to see some of what was going on because, you know, I think that they do have a lot of really great attributes as an airline and as an organization that communicates with so many different stakeholders. And to see it kind of melt down in this very particular way, in ways that other airlines weren't, then that, yeah, there was some kind of feeling bad for them.
Yeah, imagine your mind goes there first, being what you do for a living. Just sort of, oh no, they've got a mess on their hands. I mean, even the best performers still have crises and bad days, so to speak. I guess. Huh?
Absolutely. And yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, well, I mean, what kind of damage can something like this do, though, to that reputation?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, as Janine said, people do forget. That's one of the kind of good things about crises is that there's always a crisis around the corner happening in someone else's backyard. So, you know, people will forget. However, I think the unique reputation that Southwest had by being an organization that was providing lower fares, it really catered to a different kind of customer base. And meanwhile, that customer base was really interested in having fun while on a previously kind of like, you know, kind of boring experience. And so in the flights and on their social media, Southwest is different. Their flight attendants and pilots have a little bit more personality. And on their social media, for instance, they are on trend in ways that the other airlines are not. So I really think that they built a customer base that was extraordinarily loyal. And you see it playing out on their social media feeds. You know, lots of customers are now saying on Facebook comments and things like that, like, I've been a Southwest flyer for 20 years and never again. This is just, you know, ruined our Christmas and ruined this, you know, experience for us, and we're not going to go back again. Now, again, you know, memories are short sometimes, especially when you're in desperate need to go on, you know, a holiday or vacation on a budget. But I do think that they are going to have to be apologizing for a long time, and they're going to have to do things above and beyond compensation. So they are doing this compensation, you know, plan for those affected. But I think beyond that, they have to reach out over time to all of their constituents, not just those affected, to say, please trust us again. We're, you know, we still have a lot of great things going on here, and we are fixing our issues. So a lot of their kind of moving forward messaging is going to have to be around specifically how we're fixing these technology issues. And it's not going to just be a Facebook post. It's going to have to be multimedia, multi-level apologies and corrective action for, I think, a really long time.
It just seems to be a reminder that a lot of times along the way, I mean, that open, upfront communication is the best approach. I mean, is that what you'd say as a PR professional?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of PR people know there's kind of five basic image repair, or what we can call image restoration strategies. And, you know, on one end of the spectrum, it's denial. And then on the other end, it's the things that Southwest took, right? So they went straight to corrective action and they went straight to mortification. Those are kind of the strategies that are best practices for today. And so they went right to our deepest apologies. We can't believe this has happened. We can never stop apologizing. I think that was the phrasing that Bob Jordan used in one of his statements. And so they really did do that right. If any of their messaging had kind of even hinted at this wasn't our fault, or sorry, it's not as bad as you think, which are other types of denial, evasion of responsibility, reducing the offensiveness of the action, those sorts of things, that would they would have to then go back and apologize for that later on. So people wouldn't forget that. So that is something they absolutely did right, according to like the world that we're in right now. I think putting their CEO and their chief commercial officer out there apologizing using video is good. People like to see a face of an organization. And I think that, you know, they were putting out daily like updates ahead of the storm, and then to some extent afterwards on their website. But unfortunately, you know, their social media went pretty quiet pretty quickly. And again, Southwest, going back to what I mentioned earlier, really became a forerunner in social media back in 2010 when film director Kevin Smith was removed from a flight because he, you know, required two seats instead of one. And so he took to social media. He took to Twitter and started like one of the landmark social media wars with an organization. And so by not really utilizing that platform that they really gained so much credibility from over time, I think that really damaged them as well, because that's ultimately, at the end of the day, people want information. People want updates, and they go to social media a lot. And so I think that's one of the things that they will need to look at next time there is an issue, is just more updates online, even if they don't have the answers, even if they don't necessarily have exactly what is the next step. But, you know, really utilizing the channels that their customers use is going to be vital moving forward.
Yeah. Communicating even when there's maybe nothing new to say can have some value. We'll see how this all plays out and how this affects the company. Jennifer Vardaman, Associate Professor and Director of the Valeni School of Communication at U of H. Dr. Vardaman, thank you so much for your insight on this.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Up next, we look at the year ahead and consider the major stories that might arise in the realm of Houston healthcare. That's as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty filling in today for Craig Cohen. Today we're beginning a week-long series looking ahead to some of the stories expected to make news in different realms of Houston life this coming year, from politics to education to the environment. And today we start off with a look ahead to the year in healthcare here in Houston with the help of News 88.7 reporter Sarah Willa-Ernst, who joins us now. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning.
One of the first things on the calendar this year, of course, is the Texas legislature, which begins its 88th regular session on January 10th. What healthcare-related matters might you be watching coming out of Austin this year?
So my main topic will be mental health care legislation. I'm imagining there's going to be a lot of stories coming out of this topic during the legislative session. And under this kind of huge umbrella of mental health, I really want to pay attention to services and efforts for children specifically. You know, during the pandemic, there really kind of has been an unprecedented rise in the number of children facing mental health crises and ending up in the emergency room. I reported a story recently about Texas Children's Hospital, and their campuses have seen an 800% increase in ER visits since before the pandemic. And I think we can kind of, you know, speculate where that comes from, because the pandemic has really been, you know, characterized by isolation, you know, financial stressors on a lot of families and, you know, people being stuck in difficult circumstances. And that has had an outsized impact on children. And, you know, pediatric mental health is also an issue that multiple leaders in the Republican Party have mentioned as a priority for them during the next session. So, you know, I think that's an important topic, but another one to kind of keep a close eye on has to do with something that affects children and adults, and that has to do with the capacity of psychiatric inpatient beds at state hospitals. This has mostly been fueled by the staffing shortage, but there are also other reasons too. And, you know, as a result, there has been a large number of beds that are not online in the state because of these staffing issues and other reasons. And that's affecting adult facilities and a youth one too.
Speaking of facilities, one thing you've done a lot of reporting on is the plight of rural hospitals these days. Can you remind us what the state of things is for many of the state's rural hospitals these
days?
Yeah.
So, you know, before the pandemic in Texas, we led the nation in the number of rural hospital closures. But right now, 2022-2023, rural hospitals are facing a lot of the same existential challenges. Right now, it's mostly due to inflation and the growth of healthcare costs. And a recent report from the Texas Hospital Association shows that 26% of rural hospitals are at risk of closure. And that's up from 16% in 2020 and 2021.
Thanks. Anecdotally, what kinds of things are people having to do in these areas to find care when they need it? How is it affecting everyday life?
Yeah, there is definitely a significant impact on the health outcomes of people living in rural counties once a hospital closes. So people need to drive farther. And the hospitals that do remain in those rural parts, they see patient volumes grow. So, you know, there are longer wait times in theory. But, you know, there's also the economic impact too. Sometimes the hospital is the largest or the second largest employer in that county. And, you know, it can impact whether a county is able to attract businesses to set up shop there, whether that's small mom and pop places or large corporations. Because if you think about it, if you want to recruit employees, it's a pretty hard sell if there isn't a local ER or hospital in the area.
Yeah, all those amenities, quality of life things that draw people to an area. And it's like it's this kind of chicken or the egg. It's they can attract them and they don't come and they're not there. Those things don't come themselves. So this is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty. We're looking ahead to some of the stories likely to make news in the realm of healthcare in 2023 with the help of News 88.7's Sarah Willa Ernst. Another issue you've been following is something affecting the nation as a whole, really, the nursing shortage. What aspects of that problem do you want to know more about? What will you be digging into on that front this year?
Yeah, there's a couple of bills that already catch my eye. One of them has to do with education. It's kind of getting to the root of the problem and more of a long-term solution rather than a short-term one. And I think in general, when it comes to policy, there needs to be a combination of both kind of fixing the acute problems that we're dealing right now, but then also, you know, getting to the root of it is at the same time. One bill that has caught my eye is filed by State Senator Lois Kolkhorst, Senate Bill 244. And essentially, it provides incentives for nurses to get into teaching. Right now, you can make a lot more money working in a hospital than working at a university. And so this bill basically expands loan forgiveness benefits beyond people that just work full time at a university, you know, those who work part time too. And then you can kind of have the best of both worlds, both working in a hospital and a university, and universities benefiting off of the skill set of not just the education that they have, but also like the real practical skills that they have from working in a hospital.
Getting more people into the university means obviously training more nurses to get out there and fill
exactly
some of those voids. You and the other News 88.7 reporters that we're going to talk to this week are each doing some deep dive investigations in 2023. I understand you're still maybe deciding what yours will be this year, right?
Yeah. I think right now I'm still in the pre-reporting stages, figuring out just exactly what topics are worth investing a lot of resources into and investigating further. I definitely will kind of keep an eye out when it comes to mental health during the legislature, and I think I'll learn a lot about that topic, and a story will just kind of fall into my lap as a result. But another topic I'm really interested in is the impact long COVID is having on Texans. I've done a couple stories on it already, and you know, the human stories that I've heard so far is that, you know, it's not just an illness, but more and more so it's being recognized as a disability. And for people that are kind of struggling with the impacts of what can often be an invisible disease, it's often not, you know, something that you can see physically. You know, how are they kind of getting through their day-to-day lives? How are they getting through school? How are they getting through work? And are there really the appropriate accommodations as a result to help, you know, people that are dealing with this disability that has growing recognition, you know, live kind of a normal, to the best of their abilities, everyday life?
Yeah, people dealing with these long-term symptoms and problems related to having COVID. Of course, it's a long year. We never know where the reality of breaking news is going to take us in a given year. So plenty of things can arise in the coming months that might get on your reporting radar. But how can people get in touch with you if maybe they have an idea or suggestion, maybe even some information they want to share with you about any of these stories?
Yeah, I'm always open to stories that have to do with health. And if something interesting regarding your health or your access to healthcare is happening in your personal life, I'm definitely all ears. And you can reach me on Twitter. My handle is SarahWilla1, and my name is S-A-R-A without the H. And my email address is swernst@houstonpublicmedia.org. And, you know, I'm covering the legislative session, and this is really a time for people to think about, you know, the ways in which their lawmakers can serve them. And, you know, these are people that I am in theory going to be interviewing. And so the questions and the concerns that you have for your lawmakers are also the questions and concerns that I want to bring to the lawmakers. So, you know, can definitely reach out to me through those mediums, and it can, you know, shape my reporting in some ways.
And again, we'll put that information on our today's post for at HoustonMatters.org as well. If you didn't get a chance to jot that down, you can also go to HoustonPublicMedia.org and the contact page and the Meet the Staff, and all of our emails, I believe, are on there for the on-air staff and stuff. When you do these deep dive investigations, what do you enjoy about that and getting to do records requests and all that kind of deep dive digging stuff?
I think reaching the flow state and just getting the privilege of trying to fulfill my like insatiable curiosity when it comes to certain things. You just kind of, you know, you have all these threads and you just kind of pick at it. And sometimes, you know, it's annoying and like you get nothing from your efforts. But then other times you'll come across a golden nugget that makes it feel like the whole entire, you know, investigation or the work that you're doing is really worth it.
Imagine that is an exciting feeling to find that. It takes a special kind of person and, you know, kind of curiosity nerds, for lack of a better term. But hopefully that's not offensive. Nerd is not offensive term to people anymore.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So it's exciting to see people find their thing and get into it and dig into it and find answers. The whole newsroom, the news reporters we'll be talking to this week are doing that same kind of thing. And we'll continue our series talking to them, looking ahead to what they're investigating and what stories they're expecting will make news in different realms of Houston life tomorrow. We'll continue tomorrow with a look at the year ahead in education. Sarah Will Ernst, though, covers healthcare for News 88.7. Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Just ahead, why the lie detector test is still being used despite some unreliability. That's as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty. A new documentary from the PBS series American Experience delves into the history of a piece of technology that once held almost magical potential in the minds of the nation for the world of criminal justice, the polygraph or lie detector test.
It was a genuine attempt, a well-meaning attempt, to try to solve crimes without using violence. The truth would come out through science.
Americans want to believe that somehow there is this one truth and we have the ability to reach in and use this technology and determine what it is.
Like Frankenstein's monster, the machine escaped its creator's control.
A polygraph's a very blunt instrument.
It's open to interpretation.
But in popular culture, we've come to see lie detectors as entirely accurate.
The media propelled this instrument into this place in pop culture that we have yet to escape.
Highlights there from The Lie Detector, a new documentary from the PBS series American Experience. It airs tonight at 8 on Houston Public Media, TV 8. Here to discuss how the lie detector test is used in criminal cases and what we know about its flaws is Dr. Jake Koons. He's an assistant professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. Dr. Koons, good morning.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Just going to give me the rough history of the polygraph. Where did it come from and how did it begin to be used?
Well, it came from Berkeley, California. There was a police officer there by the name of John Larson, who oddly enough had a PhD. And he was out there in California, and he was with the Berkeley Police Department, who at the time was headed by August Vollmer, who was one of the giants in the professional era of American policing. And it was pretty common at the time to give suspects the third degree, which literally meant beating them, in order to get a confession out of them. And they wanted to come up with a scientific method of determining whether or not someone was telling the truth. So it began with the best of intentions. Now, Dr. Larson hired a young a high school student to help him by the name of Keeler. And they developed this instrument, which used blood pressure cuff and breathing rate. And it would basically draw, it had a piece of chalk and it would draw on a wheel. And it would measure the changes. It was first put to use in case out there at the University of California, where there were some thefts. And Larson was polygraphing each one of the suspects. One stood out. And as a result of the results of the polygraph that she failed, her life was kind of put in a tailspin. And this horrified Larson, who as a holding a doctorate, was very schooled in science. Well, it went on, and there was a guy by the name of William Marston who took it up, kind of tried to do the same thing, and it kind of developed into a sideshow. So that's kind of where it's got its start in policing, to get away from the third degree, as was brought out in the Wickersham committee hearings.
Almost sounds like
basically.
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, it sounds like it started with maybe some good intentions, and of course, it stems from an era when science, the possibilities of science, was endless. We thought we could do all kinds of things. We're going to have flying cars someday, and then a box that can tell us whether someone's lying or not. I mean, but obviously, we know now that there were some flaws in the test. What are the flaws in the polygraph?
Well, the problem is you're dealing with human beings, and that is very, very tough. The polygraph is very good at being able to measure changes in galvanic skin response, in breathing rate, in blood pressure. It does that just fine, just like the instruments in your doctor's office. The problem comes is when we want to take that next step and say, okay, due to the fluctuations here in these readings, we're going to say that you're lying or that you're telling the truth. And in science, if you're claiming something to be a valid point, it has to be repeatable. In other words, given the same circumstances, the same events, you need to reach the same conclusion. And you simply can't do that with a polygraph.
Are there certain kinds of people or situations that it doesn't work well on?
Well, if you're dealing with a sociopath or a psychopath, and a psychopath, best example is probably Ted Bundy. Yeah, because they have no guilt over their actions, no matter how horrific they may or may not be. But there could also be some issues with, let's say you're going through a terrible time mentally, emotionally, going through a divorce, something like that. That could affect the results. And basically, you have the operator who's looking at this graph and trying to make sense out of, you know, whether or not this is the truth. So a lot of it depends on how the questions are formulated, the skill of the operator in order to interpret those results.
Can you give me an example of how maybe the questions might be formulated wrong or in a way that would skew the results?
Sure. Unlike what you see on television, a polygraph test doesn't involve a conversation like we're having now. You're asking me questions. I'm giving you answers. You have a pre-determined set of questions, and the test subject is going to be told these. And you intersperse routine questions with the test questions. In other words, what's your name? Do you live in Texas? You know, things that are fairly well understood. But then you have the test questions. Did you rob this bank? Now, the problem of it is if you don't formulate those test questions precisely and the subject is interpreting the answer to that question maybe with another event in their life, that can skew the results.
Is there, when you look at I know that the lie detector polygraph is not admissible in court in some places as much as it used to, but I mean, is it still used by law enforcement? How is so compared to in the past?
Oh, absolutely. And the polygraph never had a successful history in court. It really didn't. Again, because it is not scientifically reliable. But law enforcement uses it basically to it's an investigative tool among many investigative tools. So if you have a suspect and you would like to elicit a confession out of this individual, you can put them on through a polygraph test. You can confront them with the results that's saying, look, you're lying. We know you're lying. We know you did this. And you know what? It's time to get right.
So still maybe still possibly some value in it for law enforcement, at least, is creating a wedge with suspects then perhaps.
Exactly. To get them to finally confess to what they've done. And that confession elicited in that manner is perfectly admissible in court.
The Lie Detector is a new documentary from the PBS series American Experience. It airs tonight at 8 on Houston Public Media, TV8. And Dr. Jay Koons is an assistant professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. Dr. Koons, thanks so much for taking time to explain all this to us.
You bet. Happy to. Take care.
And just ahead, before the robots come and take our jobs, and before they become sentient and we have to send someone back in time to destroy them, hey, someone's got to design them, right? So why not kids? Stay with us as Houston Matters continues. Last spring, students from around the world gathered at Houston's George R. Brown Convention Center to compete in the annual FIRST Robotics Championships. That's FIRST as in For Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. It's an international youth robotics organization promoting science, engineering, math, and community. Last April's championship featured a number of robotics competitions across 4 days, and our own William Menhivar visited the event where he met up with some local teams.
It was hard not to feel sensory overload when I walked into the George R. Brown Convention Center. Music and play-by-play commentary echoed through the grand ballroom, while robots resembling Mars rovers were being carted to their matches. This is the first in-person championship in 2 years, and the first one held solely in Houston since 2003.
The Cyber Vipers putting on the pressure. And 57-12 coming across.
There's a theme for each year's championship. This year, it's the future of transportation. Menasha, outreach captain of the Robonauts, team 118 from League City, explains this year's game, Rapid React.
This year, there are two main methods of scoring. There's cargo that you shoot. They're basically giant tennis balls, and you shoot them into either the upper or lower hub. We choose upper. It gives you more points. And there's also a climbing endgame where you have to basically traverse a set of monkey bar-shaped rungs all the way up to the traversal rung, which is where we aim for every time.
We're in the Robonauts pit now, one of the hundreds of booths inside the convention center where teams work on their machines.
So this is Horizon, our 2022 robot. It runs a swerve drive base, so we prefer swerve drive for this year. It's really effective at being fast, zipping around the field, evading defense, because you can rotate 360 degrees while moving in a straight line as well. So it's really great for this year specifically when it's kind of a defense-heavy game. There's not a lot of game pieces on the field, so a lot of robots are going to be trying to play defense on you, stopping you from shooting the limited cargo. So having a fast and, you know, able to maneuver robot is really important this year, especially with the level of defense we're seeing. We have this roller intake here. As you can see, the wheels are literally made out of foam floor tile mats. It's a material that we found worked best with this year's game piece. It's powered by pneumatics, so it lifts up and down and will spin by this Falcon motor over here. We have a turreted shooter. It has 270 degrees of rotation, minus the 90 because our climb is blocking that over here. And then this is our climber subsystem, the one that I worked on this year. It is a rotating arm concept with hooks that are powered by this pneumatic here that latch on each bar. We start at the mid, go up to the high, and then to the traversal rung, all in a very fast 6 to 8 second sequence.
But seeing the robot in the pit was nothing compared to seeing it in action during a game.
And over here on blue, Team 118. From Texas, it's Robonauts.
The team moves the robot into place, then it's hands off for 15 seconds while the robot goes into autonomous mode. The machine uses sensors to aim and shoot the ball from any distance until the 15 seconds are up. Then it's remote control play from there.
Match number 39 underway here at Galileo. A good series of red and blue line cargo gets delivered into that upper hub for maximum value. Drivers step forward and take control of their robots. Move into tele-operated period. 30 to 28 favoring the Blue Alliance. Team 118, the Robonauts, utilizing a nifty spur system, managed to outmaneuver the defensive plays by the Red Alliance as they fire off a volley of cargo into that upper hub.
After each match, the team heads back to the pit to troubleshoot before the next game. Team Captain Hannah breaks down their adjustments.
We did blow one of our pneumatic hoses, so that just happens when there's not enough strain relief on one of the hoses. So we lengthened that, we switched out with another one, and so now we have to pressurize our entire pneumatic system now, and so that requires like turning on the robot, which we'll do all while we're queuing for our next match. So it's like intense moments like these that are, it's a little bit of an issue, but our pit crew is really well trained, and so we can handle a lot of things.
High schoolers aren't the only students at the first championship. Meet the DAV Ultimate Shippers, team 25379 from Houston.
My name is Jasmine Kadakia, and I'm the safety specialist for this team, and I'm in fourth grade.
My name is Soham Jigran, I'm in fifth grade, and I'm the operations manager.
My name is Sian, and I'm in fifth grade, and I am the machine operator.
My name is Raj. I am the courier and I'm in fourth grade.
My name is Rudan Sharda and I'm the coder and I'm in fourth grade.
They are 9 and 10 year olds taking part in the first Lego League Explore competition, which challenges them to build model shipping centers using Legos. The Ultimate Shippers Center is filled with carriers, sorters, and a crane they control by code written on an iPad.
It took so long to code. Either it would go too far up or too far down. So we had to like perfect it and make it at an angle.
Hold up the crane. So here the motor speed is 2. And then when it's going down, it makes a beeping noise. And then our motor rotates. And then it waits. And then it makes the beeping noise again. And then it turns around and then waits.
And then if the code went wrong, I was the one to solve the problem why it was going wrong.
Their coach, Pari Sharda, says he's just there to facilitate their ideas.
The challenge with the kids is they have so many ideas. As an adult, we always restrict ourselves within a box. But when it comes to kids, these guys are so innovative. So the challenge becomes how we translate that idea into a working model. So many times even I ran out of ideas. But then I think the collective problem solving, which we worked, was good.
But the first championship is more than just a competition. Erica Fessia is Vice President of Global Field Operations for FIRST. And she tells me the event is also about fostering community and collaboration, something the kids exemplified during the pandemic.
Certainly the pandemic did interrupt our programming. And what our students did was be what they have learned to be, which is resilient and creative about how to use their skills and continue to build their skills. So we created new remote challenges for them to engage in, but they also looked at the needs of their local communities and identified ways that they could help. We had a team use their robot to deliver groceries from the store into the parking lot to keep safely distanced during the pandemic. We also had teams who were using the parts from their robots to build unique respirators. We had teams using their fabrication to build face shields and sew masks. So the students took the skills that they've been learning and the energy and passion for solving problems and applied it in a very real world, very serious challenge that they faced.
Everyone here epitomizes this sense of community, including high school freshman Connor, who works on the Robonauts Robo-Rescue Team, where he assists other teams with any problems they have. His passion for helping others radiates out of him.
I don't remember their exact team number. Their robot was accidentally shipped to Arkansas. So we helped them, us and a bunch of other teams, help them assemble a kit bot so they are able to compete now until their robot gets delivered. I feel so bad. I walked up and I was like, hey guys, I noticed y'all's robot isn't here yet. Would you like some help? And they're like, no, it got shipped to Arkansas. And I didn't know how to respond. It was very sad.
Well, you helped out in the best way possible, it seemed, by helping him put something together. What's it like to put a robot together last minute from the ground up?
It's very fun. I mean, it's a learning experience for the other team and for us. You know, we working together with other teams, which is not something that happens a lot here. Like, you don't normally build with another team, but it honestly, it's taught me so much, and I feel like they have learned from us, and I've definitely learned from them.
Was that the only team you've helped out so far? Have you helped anyone else?
No, we've actually gone to a lot of teams today and was like, hey guys, we noticed that you experienced some comms death. If you cannot identify the problem, you could come over to 118's pit. We have people who have been doing this for years. Like, anything, any help that we can give you, come and ask. We're always open. We're always ready.
For Houston Matters, I'm William Menjivar.
57-12, running up even higher is two red robots. Hang for the traversal run, 15 points apart. 3 seconds remaining, 2-1.
Scenes there from the International FIRST Robotics Championship, which was held at the George R. Brown Convention Center back in April. This year's competition is back in Houston, April 19th through the 22nd. Well, that does it for this edition of Houston Matters. Our team includes Craig Cohen, Joshua Zinn, Troy Schultz, and William Menjivar. Jared Carroll is our technical director. Remember to join Ernie Manous for Town Square this afternoon at 3 on News 88.7. On today's show, if you've made a resolution or want to make healthy changes in your life this year, Terry the Trainer from The League will be here with tips on how to make those changes and keep them. That's this afternoon at 3. On tomorrow's Houston Matters, we discuss the latest developments in the world of politics in our weekly roundup, and we look forward to the year ahead in education in Houston. Craig Cohen is back tomorrow. I'm Michael Haggerty. Join him tomorrow for those and other Houston Matters.